says Bami on the front. Jonas studied writing and English literature at Brown, then photography at the Rhode Island School of Design and at the Design Institute at Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago. In 1969, he introduced me to a magazine editor and got me my first assignment. He and I have been working and traveling together ever since. He takes the pictures. I write the words. When I got my pilot's license, Jonas was my first passenger, and the bug bit him so hard that he built his own replica of a two-seater Italian fighter plane, the Falco, in which we've flown all over the United States. I like to travel with Jonas because he's a survivor. Like me, he's been after it since childhood. Jonas is cool. I named my son after him. So when I went to survivor school, it seemed natural to me that Jonas should come along. We took off from Pittsfield, Massachusetts, sharing the flying duties, and landed in Lynchburg, Virginia. As I climbed out of the cockpit and onto the wing, I caught my first glimpse of our instructor. Byron Kearns runs the Mountain Shepherd Survival School. He swaggered across the fueling ramp toward us wearing an 18-inch Panamanian machete on his belt, a big, macho-looking guy with 12 years of military experience, including a stint with the Marines. He had worked at the famous Air Force Survival School in Washington State. When I saw him, I thought, we're in for it now. That night, Byron explained that we were going to head off into the Virginia woods the next morning, early, and we'd be drilling for several days on such matters as map and compass work, firecraft, shelter, and signaling. We'd learn to find water or distill it from the air. We would not think about food because it wasn't necessary. The Air Force plan was that you'd be found within 3 days. Your job, he said, is to stay alive for 72 hours. When he left, Jonas said, this guy's going to whip you like a red-headed stepchild. Early the next morning, as we moved up a rocky river drainage through the mountains, I noticed that Kearns would stop frequently to point out something of beauty or interest. He spoke softly, as if we were in a church. He laughed a lot. He liked to be still and just think or smoke a cigarette. I saw no sign of the drill sergeant I'd expected. In our first exercise, Kearns asked me and Jonas to make a fire, and in a matter of minutes we had a roaring blaze going. Kearns had turned away to get something from his pack. When he turned back, the flames were leaping several feet off the ground. "Whoa," he said, laughing. "Easy, easy. I just wanted to know if you could start a fire. Some people can't." Then he gently separated the pile of wood and put it out. Byron Kearns turned out to be soft-spoken, polite, cheerfully earnest, and gentle to a fault. He moved slowly, never hurried, and was always careful assessing himself and his environment. He wasn't prone to high emotional states. He carried with him a contagious air of calm. He reminded me of my father, actually. Like so many retired pilots, my father wore soft shoes, talked softly, and walked softly. As a pilot, you want to wear soft shoes so that you can feel the rudder pedals. You don't want to make sudden, unplanned motions in a combat aircraft cockpit where the controls are sensitive and lots of things can explode. That demeanor, once learned under penalty of death, is carried through the rest of your life. Kearns also had that quiet, dark, and private humor. Even after a lifetime in the wilderness, Kearns entered the woods with a deep sense of respect and humility, like a man approaching a magnificent, dangerous, and unpredictable creature. It's the same way a good pilot approaches his aircraft. As we worked in the wilderness, learning technical skills, Kearns kept talking about positive mental attitude. It was the number one item on the checklist he'd given us, and that checklist was from the big daddy of all checklist writers, the U.S. Air Force. Positive mental attitude. It must be important, I told Jonas. Yeah, but what is it? He asked. Think good thoughts and you'll be saved? I'd rather have a chainsaw and a cheeseburger, Jonas said. A cell phone and a GPS would be nice, too. As we slogged through the woods, practicing firecraft, shelter-making, knots, and navigation, while the mammoth Virginia ticks gnawed on our privates, I kept asking Kearns, but he couldn't explain it. Nobody could. It meant the difference between life and death. He could tell me that. He had an adult portion of it. He assured me of that. "It's not what's in your pack," he'd say. "It's what's in here." He'd tap his chest. No wonder Tom Wolfe had called it the right stuff. You couldn't exactly title a book Positive Mental Attitude, now could you? Kearns didn't always have it, though. He'd had to acquire it. Early on in his Air Force days, he took a group of pilots into the mountains near Spokane for survival training maneuvers. "I was a greenhorn and just misjudged our situation," he told us. Back then he was pretending to be the macho drill instructor I'd expected. Go, 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 push, push, push. He was not yet cool. He was acting cool. His class had been crossing a vast field of slushy snow, which made the going rough. The pilots began to suffer from fatigue, but Kearns kept driving them. "I now realize that was a mistake," he said. As the temperature dropped, darkness came down like a curtain. Suddenly everybody wanted to give up. They just sat down and lost all their will. Apathy is a typical reaction to any sort of disaster, and if you're exhausted in a field of snow at sundown in the mountains, you're pretty much about to witness the simple disaster of nature separating you permanently from everything you know and love in this world. That apathy can rapidly lead to complete psychological deterioration. Then you sit down and hypothermia sets in, which produces more apathy, a more profound psychological deterioration, and ultimately death. Fatigue almost always comes as a surprise. It is as much a psychological condition as a physical one, and scientists have struggled without success to understand it. It's like the difficulty of studying sand in order to understand the sandpile effect. There's nothing in the muscles or nerves or even the biochemistry of the body that would seem to predict or explain fatigue. Once fatigue sets in, though, it is almost impossible to recover from it under survival conditions. It is not just a matter of being tired. It's more like a spiritual collapse, and recovery requires more than food and rest. Following the explosive burst of activity that is sometimes required for survival, or in the panic stage when you're running or climbing or swimming, you're like a woman who's just given birth to a baby. You're depleted and wide open to fatigue. It may take weeks to recover, and if you're not taking care of yourself, that fatigue can lead to an inability to sleep, which in turn can result in a sudden psychological collapse. The physical and psychological factors rapidly erode each other, which is why it is so important to pace yourself, rest frequently, and stay hydrated. That's why Kearns pushing the pilot so hard had been a mistake. A survival situation is a ticking clock. You have only so much stored energy and water, and every time you exert yourself, you're using it up. The trick is to become extremely stingy with your scarce resources, balancing risk and reward, investing only in efforts that offer the biggest return. In survival situations, people greatly underestimate the need for rest. While Kearns, Jonas, and I were doing map and compass exercises, he would frequently stop and look around at the woods, chatting with us. I'd be thinking, let's go, I know the way, and he'd just stand there. Now I understand why. You should operate at about 60% of your normal level of activity, he explained, and rest and rehydrate frequently. If the weather is cool and you're sweating, you're working too hard. I'd had the same lesson when I was training with Air Force fighter pilots to fly combat aircraft. I'd show up for the morning briefing, and when it was over, I'd be pacing around in my speed jeans with my helmet cradled like a baby in my arms, wondering why we weren't running out to the ramp to kick the tires and light the fires. Everyone would just sit around as if we had nowhere to go. It seemed like hours before my instructor would slowly get up and saunter toward the door, glancing at his watch, and suggest, "What do you say we go up two ship with the colonel, get the heck out of the coffin, and then maybe pick up a little contact over Hondo?" Calm as you please, as if we were going to wander over to the commissary for a jalapeno sub. When Kearns at last realized how serious his situation was with his fatigued Air Force pilots, he recounted, I fell to my knees and I prayed. Faith is a very important thing in your will to survive. As Peter Leszak put it, whether a deity is actually listening or not, there is value in formally announcing your needs, desires, worries, sins, and goals in a focused, prayerful attitude. Only when you are aware can you take action. Survival psychologists have observed the same thing. Kearns added, "All at once it hit me that I might actually lose them. Those million-dollar pilots could die." By chance, he found a fence and used the cedar post to start a fire. Chance is nothing more than opportunity, and it is all around at every turn. The trick lies in recognizing it. It's amazing to see what fire can do. You're out in the woods, you're cold, you're lost, you're lonely. But the minute you light that fire, you're home. The lights are on, and supper's cooking. It made a world of difference going from complete darkness to light and warmth. It just turned everybody around. Kearns learned many lessons that night. His mastery and confidence turned the pilots around even more than the fire. It showed them the way, and it made Kearns more able to save himself. That lesson was driven home again and again. Helping someone else is the best way to ensure your own survival. It takes you out of yourself. It helps you to rise above your fears. Now you're a rescuer, not a victim. And seeing how your leadership and skill buoy others up gives you more focus and energy to persevere. The cycle reinforces itself. You buoy them up and their response buoys you up. Many people who survive alone report that they were doing it for someone else, a wife, boyfriend, mother, son, back home. When Antoine de Saint-Exupéry was lost in the Libyan desert, it was the thought of his wife's suffering that kept him going. Mark Gamba is a steep creek boater and a photographer I've worked with. When we were at Mount Hood together, he told me of getting caught in a strainer, which is usually fatal. A strainer is a tree that's fallen across a river. Ordinarily, people who are washed into a strainer are pinned by the force of the current. Mark was pinned, and each time he reached up to pull himself out over the trunk of the tree, the current caught his legs and dragged him back down. He managed to get his nose out of the water and snatch a breath, but then he was pulled under again and again. He was exhausting himself. His arms were burning, his lungs were exploding. He began to see blackness creeping in from the edges of his vision as the retina was robbed of oxygen. "I thought of my son," he said. "I wanted to see him again." And as he blacked out, he gave it one last try. In a tremendous burst of energy, he pulled himself up and over the log. In the 84th floor offices of the World Trade Center's South Tower, and an hour before the collapse, Ronald DeFrancesco was one of the people who met Brian Clark, the fire warden with a flashlight who was asking people up or down. DeFrancesco went up, hoping to find air. But after 10 or so floors, he encountered people who were succumbing to fatigue and smoke. The people, all of whom would die, were just giving up and falling asleep. DeFrancesco, too, was collapsing, but then he said to himself, "I've got to see my wife and kids again." And with that, he got up and bolted down the stairs to safety. Doctors and nurses often survive better than others because they have someone to help. They have a well-defined purpose. Purpose is a big part of survival, but it must be accompanied by work. Grace without good works is not salvation. The survivor plans by setting small, manageable goals and then systematically achieving them. Hence the Air Force checklist and the notion, which my father drilled into me, plan the flight and fly the plan. But don't fall in love with the plan. Be open to a changing world and let go of the plan when necessary so that you can make a new plan. Then, as the world and the plan both go through their book of changes, you will always be ready to do the next right thing. People are animals with animal instincts, but they lack many of the other survival mechanisms animals possess, such as fur to keep them warm, fangs and claws, and flight or speed. Culture creates a collective survival mechanism for the species. People survive better in numbers. They survive because they use cognition to organize, say, for a hunt, and to make things, even as cognition inhibits their animalness, including strength. That's why when cognition is turned off, people are amazed by their own strength, because cognition continuously inhibits it. That is the whole secret to cognition. It is a mechanism for modulating emotional, physical responses. Every culture evolves survival rituals. Some, especially non-technical ones, are devoted to not much more than survival. In Native American cultures, one ritual is the vision quest, in which a young person goes into the wild and fasts in search of a vision. It can be seen as a type of survival training, for if there is no food, no water, no way, a person has already practiced sitting still and making the best of the situation. He'll have confidence in his ability to survive it. The survival lessons that apply today are ancient. The Tao Te Ching is broken into two parts, integrity and the way, which can be thought of as the two halves of surviving anything. Lao Tzu's book is a handbook for a ruler, but it is also a handbook for the brain. An imbalance of the brain's functions leads us into trouble, and the triumph of balance gets us out. I found similar lessons in Epictetus, Herodotus, Thucydides, the Bible, the Bhagavad Gita. "Is there anything whereof it may be said, 'See, this is new,'" says Ecclesiastes. "But there are always new people who haven't heard that there's nothing new under the sun, and there's always some son of a bitch who doesn't get the word." I had always wondered where our American survival rituals were. I think now that they're everywhere around us. The Boy Scouts, in its original conception, was a survival school. Sports are survival training, in that they teach strength, agility, strategy, and the endurance of pain. But our culture is filled with survival stories as well. Cool is the ultimate American conception of the survival model. James Stockdale, a fighter pilot who was shot down over Vietnam in 1965, spoke many times about how he survived 7.5 years in prison camp. "One should include a course of familiarization with pain," he said. Stockdale observed, "You have to practice hurting. There is no question about it. You have to practice being hazed. You have to learn to take a bunch of junk and accept it with a sense of humor." He's talking about being cool, just as he was when his F-8 fighter bomber was hit with 57-millimeter fire. He had been on a relaxed bomb run at the time. He'd even taken off his uncomfortable oxygen mask. "I could barely keep that plane from flying into the ground while I got that damned oxygen mask to my mouth so I could tell my wingman that I was about to eject. What rotten luck, and on a milk run. My mind was clear, and I said to myself, 5 years. I knew we were making a mess of the war in Southeast Asia, but I didn't think it would last longer than that." The Spartan practice of enduring the bite of the fox is a course of familiarization with pain. Then there are the schools like Kearns's, which attempt to teach us wilderness survival by directly meeting the problem head-on with Yankee ingenuity. Like being lost, survival is a transformation. Being a leader can ensure that when you reach the final stage of that metamorphosis, it is with an attitude of commitment, not resignation. The transformation of survival is permanent. People who have had the experience often go on to become the best search and rescue professionals. They have come to understand, perhaps unconsciously, that they can only live fully by helping others through that same transformation. All the survivors I've talked to have told me how horrible the experience was, but they have also told me, often with deep puzzlement, how beautiful it was. They wouldn't trade the experience for anything in the world. It gradually dawned on me that only by researching and dissecting the mysterious quality the Air Force so dully called positive mental attitude would I ever understand survival. And I thought, wait a minute. My father was in the Army Air Corps. Maybe that's what he had that allowed him to live. If so, he'd certainly never talked about it, but what pilot would? I felt as if I'd stepped to the edge of the very thing I'd been after all my life. Here, concealed in the most unimaginative phrase possible, was the deep mystery I'd been trying to unravel. There are two schools of thought on survival training. Byron Kearns' Mountain Shepherd Survival School is of the modern technical sort. Mark Morey's Vermont Wilderness Survival School in Brattleboro, Vermont, is based on ancient native skills. Although they seem superficially different, I think they share important similarities. When Jonas and I finished Kearns' course, we hopped into the plane and roared off, heading toward the Green Mountains. At Morey's school, we were led deep into the woods where we found a group of children moving silently through the forest pretending to be deer. They were all about 8 years old, and as we watched, they cupped their hands to their ears to amplify sounds in the quiet woods. An instructor snapped a twig, and they scattered into the forest and vanished. My first thought was that if they tried that drill where I came from in Texas, they'd wind up riding home strapped to the hood of a Ford F-250 pickup truck. We caught up with them 100 yards further on, and Morey sat them down and told them a story loosely based on Jack London's To Build a Fire. As he finished and the main character froze to death, their eyes were wide. Then Morey said, "Now, I've just fallen in a stream, and my feet are wet. I'm freezing cold. We have only one match. My feet are encased in ice. I'll die in 5 minutes unless I have a fire. Build me a fire. Go." The children began gathering tinder, kindling, and fuel, working quickly and without comment. As Morey counted off the minutes, they expertly laid the fire and had it going in 4 minutes 15 seconds. They worked harmoniously, putting self aside and helping each other. But the exercise wasn't entirely about firecraft. "What we're doing," Morey explained as we made our way through the woods, "is loss-proofing these kids by building empathy and observational skills. In that last exercise, we demonstrated something we've discussed with them. The fight for survival requires a burst of energy. You have to become like a weasel, moving fast and getting the job done. Those kids just saved my life by building a fire. One day, they may save a life for real. They're learning to put the needs of the group ahead of their own." Morey is one of the few people I've ever met who would survive being dropped naked into the woods. He's the Robinson Crusoe I was hoping to find when I reread Defoe's novel. He even looks a bit like the original cover illustration. The real Crusoe was a bit disappointing. He had a Walmart full of stuff to sustain him, which he salvaged from the grounded ship just offshore, including guns, powder, and livestock. It's fitting that Morey chose London's story. The unnamed main character in To Build a Fire was not aware of the forces he was entraining, though he'd been warned. He developed no secondary emotion to permit him to believe what he'd been told. He'd had just enough experience with the cold to make him think he already knew what was up. His cup was full, and he could not receive the wisdom of the old-timer who told him not to go off alone into the Alaskan wilderness. Motion held more allure than staying still, and so he engaged himself with an unstable system. The system was composed of his body, which had to remain at 98.6 degrees, more or less, and an environment where the temperature was 70 degrees below zero. With nearly 170 degrees of difference between the two, the second law of thermodynamics would ensure that any mistake on his part would send his energy level cascading rapidly down toward fatal hypothermia. He failed to anticipate the interaction of forces that would result from his stepping into a stream and flooding his boots. In moments, his feet froze solid. Now, under stress, he failed to take in new information. In his haste, he built his fire beneath a tree that was laden with snow. It was one of those non-linear kickback systems that was tightly coupled and that magnified trouble when upset. The sandpile effect. London described all this long before chaos or complexity theory had been developed. His story touches on the most important elements of surviving in a spare and systematic manner. Each bough was fully freighted. Each time he had pulled a twig from the tree, he had communicated a slight agitation to the tree. An imperceptible agitation, so far as he was concerned, but an agitation sufficient to bring about the disaster. High up in the tree, one bough capsized its load of snow. This fell on the boughs beneath, capsizing them. The process continued, spreading out and involving the whole tree. It grew like an avalanche, and it descended without warning upon the man and the fire, and the fire was blotted out. The man was shocked. Then he grew very calm. The man had skills, equipment, and experience. It was his attitude that killed him, his inability to balance emotion and reason. He wasn't a newcomer to that country. He'd been out when it was 50 below, and he'd been fine. He'd gotten his feet wet before, built a fire, and been fine. But at 70 below, the system was driven so hard it exhibited a new and surprising behavior, one he'd never seen before. He had no idea of the transformations that can occur at such a critical boundary. Maury, Jonas, and I reached another group of children who were working on making fire with bow drills. I'd never seen fire made that way and hardly believed it was possible. Then I watched a 10-year-old boy named Jacob make a roaring fire in about 10 minutes. I asked him how long it had taken to learn. He told me 2 years. With a smirk, Maury asked Jacob if he was a master. Jacob said, no, it could take a lifetime to master this. The skills were not mere skills. They were long-held practices that developed an attitude of quiet humility. They encouraged a slow, thoughtful, confident examination of the self and the environment. That afternoon, I began work on my own fire, and it took me 2 grueling days. By the end of the first evening, I was frustrated, agitated, and irritated with this smug little Robinson Crusoe who could make flames leap from his fingertips on a whim. I didn't have any warm fire to sit by, and he wasn't going to make one for me. I'd had one MRE meal ready to eat that day, and I was exhausted. All I had to show for my efforts was a bunch of strips of basswood bark, a few sticks, a chipped rock, and a ball of useless grass. It was making me angry. I wanted a flamethrower, a pizza, and some CDs. I wanted a drink. It wasn't until I left the school and thought about it for a while that I realized fire was not the point. Maury was trying to teach me a path to seeing and knowing the world as well as myself, to find the materials, to know which ones would work and which wouldn't, to be on intimate terms with that new world. I could not change the world. I could only change myself. To see and know that world, then, was the key to surviving in it. I had to accept the world in which I found myself. I had to calm down and begin living. As with the Zen disciplines, the archery and martial arts, the practice of such skills could move perceptions and physical experience into a place where I could calmly take correct action. Whatever the neuroscientists eventually learn, one thing seemed certain. None of Maury's students is going to go out and ignore a big old rain cloud, as I had done in Glacier National Park. Each of them is going to smell it, see it, feel it, long before it comes. He's going to ask himself, what is the correct feeling of this? What is the correct action? Maury's training was making it impossible for them to embark on the stages of becoming lost, of dying. His training would keep their mental maps true to the world, keep emotion and reason balanced, keep the eyes and ears open. Living isolated from nature, I'd gone to sleep. Safety, convenience, and efficiency are the opiates of the modern world. But I began to see that there were kinds of training that could wake me up. When I was first learning aerobatics, I was scared to death most of the time. I asked my father how he'd gotten comfortable going on those bomb runs, thinking that I might transfer the learning to the risks I was taking. "Don't get comfortable," he advised. "Get confident." As we walked through the woods, Mark would stop me and Jonas from time to time and make us listen to the birds. "Something's up," he'd say. His whole body as alert as that of a hunting dog, while his eyes darted this way and that. "Listen to how excited they are. The birds are the radar of the forest." I recalled a day when I was camping in Big Bend National Park on the Texas-Mexico border. I'd gone up into the Chisos Mountains with a naturalist named Anita to escape the heat. The previous night, the thermometer had read 108 degrees at 9 o'clock. I was in that frame of mind where bad things happen. Tired, dehydrated, and with a fair case of get-there-itis. But the heart-wrenching cries of a blue jay caught Anita's attention. She put out her hand and stopped me on the trail. I looked up, and there she was, a blue jay in a small tree by the trail, just wailing her heart out. For what? Anita pointed at the trail. There, lying across our path, was a big rattler. I'm sure I would have stepped right on it if I'd been alone. Anita was attuned to her environment, alert to asking, "What's up?" The snake had just eaten the blue jay's baby. At Mark Morey's school, I eventually managed to make fire with a bow drill. I can't take the credit. It was fire-making with training wheels. Morey helped me every step of the way, gentle, prodding, encouraging. Also, at the end, my spindle slipped, sending the fragile coal flying. But Morey delicately picked it out of the grass with a dry leaf and transferred it to a tinder bundle he'd prepared for me. Making a tinder bundle is an art in itself. It can take years to get it right. But when I cupped it in my hands and blew it to life, its power was immediate and magnificent. I felt as if I'd watched a baby being born. Like making art, making fire is a deeply human act. Through it, we know our world in a way that no animal ever will. I felt like a sorcerer. The burning bush had spoken. Morey's school is full of drama, passion, and surprises. Its lessons are meant to extend the deep connection between awareness and survival, to let us think with the mind of a child, the Zen mind, the beginner's mind. When he told us we could navigate without compass or map, Jonas and I both were pretty skeptical. We'd just come from an Air Force-style survival school where a knowledge of map and compass was paramount. But the lesson was not about finding our way in the woods. It was about navigating the human brain. As we hiked through trailless forest, Morey stopped every 20 or 30 yards to point out something, and we'd examine and discuss what we found. After we'd followed him deep into the woods, he asked us to close our eyes and point the way home. It is a humbling experience to find that you can't. I'd been following him, which is never a good idea. I had not walked my own walk, and as a result, I was lost. Morey directed our attention to the last place we'd stopped to talk. We could still see it from where we stood. Remember we talked about the bittersweet vine there? We'd taken a sample from a vine that's good for making cordage. So we hiked back to that spot. Then he pointed to another spot, where he'd shown me ways of seeing and walking that were used by Native American trackers and other Aboriginal peoples. He called it Owl Eyes and the Fox Walk, that full-body alertness I'd seen when he listened to the birds. It can put you in an altered state of perception, he said. We returned to that spot. From there, we could see the place where we thought we'd found the hoofprint of a deer, but it turned out to be the entrance to a vole tunnel. We had squatted there to discuss the difference between voles, moles, and mice. Thus, hopping from one conversation to the next, we were able to retrace our steps exactly and to remember in great detail not only where we'd been, but what we'd said and done at each spot. In what seemed to be a featureless and homogeneous forest, Morey had given us tangible cues, like road signs, which we could easily follow home. He had discovered an effortless way to embed a reliable mental map in our brains. It's called song lines, he said, and it's an ancient navigational technique used by Australian Aboriginals. In Australia, the Aborigines have a labyrinth of invisible pathways, as Bruce Chatwin wrote in the song lines, which meander all over Australia and are known to Europeans as dreaming tracks or song lines, to the Aboriginals as the footprints of the ancestors, or the way of the law. Aboriginal creation myths tell of the legendary totemic beings who had wandered over the continent in the dream time, singing out the name of everything that crossed their path, birds, animals, plants, rocks, waterholes, and so singing the world into existence. A song was both a map and a direction finder. Provided you knew the song, you could always find your way across country. If you do that when you go into the woods, Maury told us, you'll never be lost. I was cynical at first about pretending to be a deer or an owl or a fox. But when I phoned him weeks later, Maury was able to recite in detail the steps in our journey. He remembered specific fallen trees, a patch of Japanese knotweed, and the way the wind was moving the leaves on a stand of maples. It's not like I tried to remember that, he said. It's an ancient instinct, and it's still alive. It was the first time I'd heard a strategy for making the mental map match the world. Map and compass are artificial methods for doing that, and they work well. But this was deep. It was Aboriginal neuroscience, using implicit, not explicit, memory circuits to embed the map in the unconscious mind. Each child in Maury's school selects a secret spot in the woods. Every day, the students are directed to spend some time at their secret spot. They do this through all the seasons, Maury said. They learn to stop and think. They learn to be calm and alone. They will never feel that the woods are alien. So if they ever get lost or otherwise stranded, they won't panic. People revert to automatic behavior, implicit learning in an emergency. These children will automatically do the right thing. They will never lose their way. I went home enthusiastic for Maury's way of walking in the wilderness, but I quickly realized it would have to be a lifelong commitment. He estimated it would take a minimum of 5 years to learn those skills well enough to depend on them in the woods, and that would be only the beginning. On the other hand, even those of us who can't make such a commitment can benefit from his lessons. Ken Hill, for example, told me that you can learn to pay a different kind of attention in the woods without becoming a fanatic. You can learn map and compass work in a few weeks of practice. You can also learn to turn around and see where you've been, which is a means of paying attention. If you come to a fork in the road, you look back and find a cue, something different, and remember it. Perhaps talk about it. It's a modified songline. You don't have to be perfect. You can simply be better. 11. We're all going to fucking die. In January 1982, Stephen Callahan set out to cross the Atlantic alone in his boat Napoleon Solo. He started out in the Canary Islands after sailing from Lisbon. On January 29th, having determined from the charts that there was a 2% chance of a gale at that time of year, he steered away from the island of Hierro, estimating his arrival in the Caribbean by February 24th. With a video camera running to document the voyage, he roared into the teeth of a gale on February 4th. Callahan had designed his boat well, though, and he wasn't concerned. He had a glassed-in pilot house from which he could steer, and plenty of experience with storms. It was 2 days before his birthday. Just before midnight, he ate some chocolate, did an inspection, and went to bed wearing nothing but a T-shirt. It wasn't the weather that got him. He'd done everything right. His was a not-your-day kind of accident. He believes that he may have been struck by a whale. Whatever the cause, he shot out of bed at the sound of a loud noise and a rush of water exploding into the cabin. Before he could even get to his knife, he was waist-deep in water and had to dive in total darkness to cut the lines on his survival bag. He failed. As it was, Callahan barely got out with his life. Awash in water on deck, he managed to get his life raft out and into the heaving waves. He put the knife in his teeth before abandoning ship. Then he noticed the video camera. "Its red eye winks at me," he wrote in his book, Adrift. Who is directing this film? He isn't much on lighting, but his flair for the dramatic is impressive. Even as his entire life support system was being wrenched out from under him, Callahan was able to stand outside the situation and laugh at himself, pretending to be the dashing buccaneer. That's some admirable cool. Starting from the moment of the accident, it is necessary for a survivor to take control of his situation. Peter Leshak speaks of Standard Fire Order Number 10, stay alert, keep calm, think clearly, act decisively. According to this directive, the best way to meet an emergency is with sharp senses to gather information, a clear mind to analyze the information, and bold action. Add to these humor to handle strong emotions. Stephen Callahan was able to do all of those things. Compare Debbie Kiley's experience just 3 months earlier when the Ketch rig Trashman was sinking on the opposite side of the Atlantic. She and a small crew had set out on a routine yacht delivery when they encountered a hurricane. Mark Adams, the first mate, was screaming, "We're all going to fucking die! We're all going to fucking die!" In his panic, he inflated the life raft before attaching it to Trashman. The wind immediately picked it up. It blew through the rigging, skimmed the top of a wave, and vanished, Kiley reported in her book, written with Meg Noonan, Untamed Seas. Not cool. John Leach puts it this way. When the personality is ripped away, there has to be a core remaining to carry the person through. If a person can carry all his support within him, then it matters little what the external environment comprises. Adams had no core. Callahan did. Survival starts before the accident. Napoleon Solo didn't sink immediately but floated for a while. That was a result of Callahan's meticulous planning. Callahan, a boat designer, built the 21-foot cruiser himself and had included in its design several watertight compartments to prevent or prolong sinking. He kept his raft tethered to Solo, watching to see how the situation would develop. Just for the experience, he had once inflated the 4-man life raft that the U.S. Coast Guard required on his boat. He had climbed inside with 2 friends and realized how grim it would be trying to drift at sea in such a torture chamber. So he equipped Solo with a 6-man raft. The life raft had its own survival supplies, of course, but he'd provided more. Unfortunately, he'd been unable to free the large, well-stocked survival bag he'd prepared. Now, as he waited, considering his next action, he looked up and saw the moon and suddenly noticed how sharp his senses had become, an early sign of survival behavior. His perceptions didn't narrow with fear, they opened up. This phenomenon has been demonstrated experimentally. Ledoux points out that certain people, when afraid, experience activation of the amygdala, which will lead working memory to receive a greater number of inputs, and inputs of a greater variety than in the presence of emotionally neutral stimuli. Callahan was fighting a battle for control, though, and the outcome was far from decided. Cool cultural icons don't usually tell the other side of the story. It's not that cool people are unafraid. They're very afraid. But they are, as Tom Wolfe recorded, paraphrasing Saint-Exupéry, afraid to panic. This is how Callahan described those first few minutes in his 1986 bestseller, Adrift. Myriad conversations and debates flash through my mind, as if a group of men are chattering within my skull. Some of them joke, finding comic relief in the cameras busily taking pictures that no one will ever see. Others stoke a furnace of fear. I must be careful. I fight blind panic. I do not want the power from my pumping adrenaline to lead to confused and counterproductive activity. I fight the urge to fall into catatonic hysteria. I do not want to sit frozen in fear until the end comes. Focus, I tell myself. Focus and get moving. Turning fear into focus is the first act of a survivor. But Callahan's experience of myriad emotions at the same time is also a common reaction reported by people caught in the midst of a catastrophe. When the World Trade Center was hit, Sam Malisi, a firefighter on a fireboat nearby, reported that he had a strange impression of feeling every possible emotion all at once. Saint-Exupéry observed that in the heat of a crisis, the only thought you can allow yourself concerns your next correct action. In describing his passion for the lethal profession of firefighting, Leszek wrote of the dreadful, wonderful moments when fear makes you so alive you simply cannot die. At least 75% of people caught in a catastrophe either freeze or simply wander in a daze, according to some psychologists. They can't think, they can't act correctly. Others maintain that people rarely panic, but often remain calm in denial, as happened in the World Trade Center. When the United States attacked Hiroshima and Nagasaki with atomic bombs, the Japanese noticed the same phenomenon among their survivors. They named it Burabura, which means do-nothing sickness. In the days following the collapse of the World Trade Center, I noticed it among the people who kept returning there. But already Callahan was formulating a plan for action. He knew that he should stay attached to the boat as long as it was floating. He knew that he wasn't in the shipping lanes. His chances of being picked up were poor. The next step was to take bold action while exercising great caution, which is but one of the many delicate balancing acts necessary for survival. So he dove back into the flooded saloon to retrieve his survival bag. He made it out and returned to the raft. When he eventually let go of Solo, he was very well equipped, considering the circumstances. He had just saved his life by risking it, which is the essential task of every organism. No risk, no reward. No risk, no life. All the time, Callahan was analyzing his situation and working to keep his emotions with him, not against him. He knew the current would carry him west, not east, and that the first landfall was in the Caribbean, 1,800 miles away. He knew that to think of the impossibility of drifting there would excite dangerous emotions. Instead, he planned only as far as the following morning. By not thinking of the almost certain death that would result from trying to drift 1,800 miles, he was keeping himself from despair and panic. So he set up a small, attainable goal. To act is human, to succeed crucial. He was giving himself something to do and a chance for success, both of which are necessary early in the survival scenario. Again, Callahan found humor, chiding himself in a Humphrey Bogart fashion. Well, you're on your own now, kid. It was no coincidence that he thought of Hollywood movies, because they provide us with our cultural archetype for cool, from Brando and James Dean to Bogart and Dashiell Hammett's Continental Op, who believed, according to Claudia Roth Pierpont, writing for The New Yorker, emotions are a nuisance during business hours, and all his hours are business hours. Every culture has its survival rituals, and ours are found in Hollywood movies and pulp fiction. The hero stays cool, while the villain is ruled by emotion. That's why he dies. A sense of humor is not a luxury, Leach writes. It is a vital organ for survival. Foxhole humor is well known among soldiers and is an essential ingredient for survival anywhere, from being adrift at sea to finding yourself in the middle of a divorce or enduring a loved one's death. But emotion has power, too. The trick is to harness that power in the service of survival. Fear becomes sustenance, Callahan wrote. Its energy feeds action. That's what got him down into the dark, flooded cabin of the boat. It's also what got him out. Another factor in Callahan's survival was how generally well-prepared he was. In addition to all the practice he'd had, all the experience at sea, he had read a great deal. He even carried Dougal Robertson's book, Survive the Savage Sea, an account of being sunk by a whale and drifting for 38 days. He'd read about the Baileys, Maurice and Marilyn, who described in 117 Days Adrift how they'd survived that long at sea. Callahan knew that few castaways made it past a month, but significantly he knew that it was possible. He knew something that every survivor must bind to his heart with hoops of steel. Anything is possible. Callahan began solidifying his resolve. "I've got to do the best I can," he told himself. "The very best. I cannot shirk or procrastinate. I cannot withdraw. I have sometimes fooled other people, but nature is not such a dolt." He had adopted the attitude of humility so important to survival. A Navy SEAL commander told Al Siebert, the psychologist, "The Rambo types are the first to go." Scott observed the same thing during his explorations in Antarctica. The concept is ancient. The Tao Te Ching says, "He who is brave in daring will be killed. He who is brave in not daring will survive." So far, Callahan had acted like a perfect textbook survivor. He was consolidating his personality and fixing his resolve. He was also, again, putting to use the lessons in the mythology of the culture, all those survival myths that he was raised on. He was using those images to form a memory of his possible future, making it just as real as his past. When you are adrift at sea in a survival raft, within 24 hours your skin succumbs to hundreds of sores caused by the salt water. Callahan couldn't sleep because of the pain. And yet, when he managed to patch a small hole, already in the floor of the raft, he felt victorious. To take delight in small achievements, to celebrate early victories, is another hallmark of the survivor. When his spirits lifted, he remarked, "I have risen, if briefly, from my deathbed." Though it was only the first full day, Callahan had already completely converted himself from victim to survivor. It's unusual to find someone engaged in recreational activities who can achieve this so quickly and seamlessly, and with such style and grace. Those who do so are usually highly trained professionals, fighter pilots, elite mountain climbers, or firefighters. Compare Callahan's reaction with that of another sailor, Tammy Oldham Ashcraft. Her boat lost its mast in a hurricane. Although she didn't lose her vessel, her circumstances were certainly dire. Her fiancé died in the storm when he was thrown overboard, and that has to be taken into account. And now, with no engine or radio, she couldn't expect help. But she had food, water, gear, and was able to rig a sail to move the boat along and take sightings with her sextant. Callahan had to rig one up using a pencil. Ashcraft managed to sail to within sight of land, but then it was obscured again briefly. "I collapsed onto the seat locker," she reported later in National Geographic Adventure magazine. "This is hell. I'm in hell." Hysterical, I dashed down the companionway and grabbed the rifle and a box of cartridges from the locker. I loaded the rifle and, leaning against the nav station, tried to cram the barrel into my mouth. On September 11, 2001, Pasquale Buzzelli, an engineer working in the North Tower of the World Trade Center, was in an elevator at the moment of impact. He got out at the 44th floor and, despite pandemonium and heavy smoke, stepped into another elevator to his office on the 64th floor. He was persisting in denial, an emotional state that can have far-reaching effects. Everyone on his floor was calmly waiting for security to tell them what to do. He proceeded to call his pregnant wife and reassure her that everything was fine, even though she could see on television that an airliner had crashed into her husband's building. Carrying on in a kind of dream state, Buzzelli and his colleagues simply hung around until the South Tower collapsed. Not even that event motivated Buzzelli to leave. What convinced him at last was the thickening smoke. He and the others started down the stairs, and Buzzelli was between the 21st and 22nd floors when the tower collapsed. He was conscious the whole time, praying that death would take him without long suffering. He remembers the fall vividly, the rhythmic thunder as the floors pancaked one on top of another, and the rocket rush of the ride down. At last he was knocked out and remained unconscious for 3 hours. When Buzzelli awoke, he was outside in the open, but trapped high atop a piece of the wreckage, unable to get down, with fires burning nearby. When firefighters eventually spotted him, they were unable to reach him. They needed to round up some equipment before they could get him down. After they left him alone, Buzzelli panicked about being killed by the fire, even though he couldn't see any flames. So he decided to kill himself. He picked up a sharp fragment and was preparing to cut his own wrists when the fire went out of its own accord. When the firemen returned, Buzzelli changed his plan. Tammy Ashcraft didn't shoot herself either, and both she and Buzzelli were rescued. But their attitudes are not the survivor's way of looking at the world. Curiously, non-survivors don't always perish, and true survivors sometimes find themselves in circumstances where the objective hazard is simply too great, as it was for many of the victims in the World Trade Center. Debbie Kiley's and Steve Callahan's experiences present a dramatic contrast in both behavior and outcome, despite the similarity of their accidents and circumstances. This is not meant to be a criticism of Kiley, a brave and excellent sailor. It is simply a comparison for the sake of analysis. Given the crew and supplies she had, the objective hazard she faced was overwhelming. John Lipoth, captain of the Trashman, and Mark Adams, his first mate, were heavy drinkers. In addition, Mark was given to fits of very strange behavior, ranting, jerking women's panties down in bars, and veering toward violence. Brad Kavanaugh, another member of the crew, was an able seaman and not a drinker. Meg Mooney was Lipoth's girlfriend and had never been on a voyage on the open ocean before. Kiley had sailed professionally. Indeed, she was the first woman ever to sail the Whitbread Around the World race. Trashman's trip was intended to be a simple yacht delivery from Bar Harbor, Maine, to Fort Lauderdale, Florida. In the 58-foot catch, it should have been routine. Despite her bad feeling that she should not go with that motley crew, Kiley allowed herself to be bullied into it by Lipoth. But once at sea, she realized what a mistake it had been. Lipoth and Mark Adams were drunk the whole time. Meg was useless, and she and Kavanaugh were left with all the work and none of the sleep. Then they sailed into a hurricane. After one of her few breaks from being at the helm, Kiley came up on deck to find Mark raving drunk and howling into the 55-knot wind. The seas were walls of liquid granite 30 or 35 feet high. Kiley and Kavanaugh took over, leaving Lipoth and Adams to drink down below. When they were too tired to go on, they demanded that Lipoth and Adams take their turn. Kiley had to sleep. She was awakened a short while later in the middle of the afternoon to the news that the boat was sinking. All that was left after Adams lost the raft was an 11-foot Zodiac, an inflatable runabout with no supplies in it. As they were trying to get the small, semi-rigid boat into the water, Meg was thrown into the Trashman's rigging by a wave and gravely injured. Even as the crew swam from the sinking yacht, with Adams screaming hysterically, the Zodiac flipped upside down, and the five people were left clinging to the line that ran around the outside of its hull. Within 2 minutes, Trashman's masts disappeared beneath the waves. In those first minutes, Kiley was fighting her panic and experiencing that rapid shift from denial to extremely acute sensory input. "Am I really here?" she asked herself. "I could smell rubber and taste salt on my lips. I became keenly aware of the warmth of the water." She struggled for some sort of control, but found herself overwhelmed by the chemicals pouring into her system. She immediately began trying to prepare for survival, but the others were lurching haphazardly from hysteria to shock. Her situation was more difficult than Callahan's, in that she had to fight not only the sea and herself, but the crew. Given the way she tried to behave, she probably would have done much better either alone or with no one but Kavanaugh. The wind and waves kept peeling their hands away from the Zodiac's line, and when they managed to get the boat upright, the wind would flip it again, tossing everyone out. Nature loves to strip the unwary of their gear. Meg had been stripped of her clothes. Even her underpants were gone. Only her shirt remained. At one point, while trying to help Meg into the boat, Kylie noticed how badly injured the young woman was, her legs severely lacerated from the rigging cables. Kylie finally got the others to ride out the storm by sheltering beneath the inverted dinghy, where at least they